Welcome to A/B Testing Podcast, your modern testing podcast. Your hosts, Alan and Brent, will be here to guide you through topics on testing, leadership, agile, and anything else that comes to mind. Now, on with the show.
Hey, it's Alan. I am here. Brent is not here. Brent is now, believe it or not, in outer space, putting networking into one of the satellites for Satya's special cable feed of the World Cup. So instead, I have a guest I've had here before who I've followed a lot. Wonderful things to say about testing. Have Kat Obring here today. Kat, say hello and remind everybody about you and kind of what you're up to.
Hello. Hi, Alan. And thanks so much for having me again. I really enjoyed our last conversation, even though, as I just mentioned, I don't really remember what I told you.
I'll remind you in a minute.
That's old age and all that. Yeah, so I'm Kat Obring. I am the founder and sole employee of Cato Coaching. I mainly do courses, workshops for people. I also publish a lot of LinkedIn if you want to find me there and can look there. Mainly what I want to talk about, or mainly what I am interested in, is good decision making around QA and quality, really more than QA, and how we can help teams to make those good decisions. And obviously, so this used to be a lot around DevOps practices and shift left, shift right, all of that good stuff. But now the times have changed, of course, and we're all talking about AI. So I have to talk about AI, right? Because AI, I think, AI really demands good decision making more than most tools do. And you have to make good decisions to get good use of any tool, but AI specifically. So there we go.
Yeah. It sure does. And we'll talk about AI in a minute, but that's actually a really good way of putting one of my peeves is people used responsibly and with good decision making. AI is very powerful and very helpful. A lot of folks either rely too much on it or not enough on it, and take the human decision making part out of it, and then say, "Oh, AI is shit; it won't work for us." And it's like, no. So we'll get there. It's been a couple years because I took 6 months off from the podcast, and it's been a couple years since you were on the podcast. But it's interesting looking back. I'll remind you, we talked about things like, at the time, you were talking about deleting the test column from the Kanban board.
Oh, yes. And still a good thing.
Still a good thing, too. But we talked a lot about it very much aligned with what Brent and I have been talking about with modern testing, but also with Lisa Crisp and Janet Gregory on whole team quality and what that really means. Again, a lot. I'll get off of my rant on people that can't use critical thinking to define, to look at statements like that. So a lot of just ownership and you and test coaching, which we, and even people credit, they say, Brent, you and Alan have been talking about coaching and testing for a long time. And even in, and I like to point out that in Lisa and Janet's book, the first Agile testing book, chapter 5 or whatever it is on test managers, as the test, I'm paraphrasing because I haven't read the book in 15 years, but it's so the test manager role often moves to test coach. So the idea has been there a while.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because test ideas is the value of, is like one of the biggest values of testers. We can think about things. We're like, how does that need to be tested? What could go wrong? What do I need to understand more about this to instill confidence, et cetera? And then we talked a lot about your test coaching, which I thought was awesome. So are you still doing some of that Cato coaching?
I absolutely do. Yes.
Which I love. And then the world shifting into AI, and it shifted a lot. Like I left the workforce last April, and AI was around and it was popular mainly, but man, it has, in my time away from work, it has accelerated more. So I'm curious what your take has been. Like what has it been like for your work and your world watching AI explode a little bit? And there's all kinds of things to talk about here. It's like how you use it, how people are reacting to it. Like, but you are hands-on with this for a lot of your work. What are you seeing?
I am quite hands-on with AI and have been pretty much ever since AI tooling became generally available, really. So I would say probably the last 2.5-3 years. I probably started around the time we last talked, just not quite as much as now. Because, and when I say AI tooling, I use a lot of this to automate things around my business, for example, because I'm a one-woman business. Mm-hmm. So the more of the kind of drudgery admin stuff I can take away is the better that is for me, because that the more brain power I can put into actually running my business and doing thinking about what I can do better and thinking creatively about things. So, and I think that is where a lot of AI tools really shine, right? For example, mm-hmm. I have a recurring client. I write a variation of an invoice to them every month. Previously, that involved getting a CSV from them, transferring that somehow into Xero. It is not, you know, an inordinate amount of time, but it takes some time. And now I have an agent that I drop the CSV into, and then it just automatically produces my invoice, right? So this is only, I don't know, this has reduced a 30-minute thing once a month to 2 minutes once a month, right? But over time, and that can be reused, of course, for other things as well. So, it didn't take very long, because I basically let the AI build the agent itself. I fine tuned it with a few mm-hmm. things, but you know. So all of that said, I think in testing the situation is really interesting, because I really come a lot about the kind of dichotomy of a camp kind of rejoicing, saying, hooray, AI can do all the testing. We don't need either those pesky testers anymore or spend time working on those pesky tests, depending on who you talk to, right? And then the other camp, who is very much, no, you cannot let AI test anything, because you can't trust anything that comes out of it. And
it's a false dichotomy, right? I mean, you're going there. This one pisses me off too.
Right? But you're kind of like, yeah, but neither of these things is actually true, right?
That really bugs me. So it's interesting. I'm going to build on something you said around. You took this task that was a little menial. You could do it. It took 30 minutes. It wasn't the most exciting work of the day. And the thing is, it's not just that it was 30 minutes of work versus 2 minutes. It's that work that did not bring you any joy at all.
Yes.
Other than the paycheck coming in at the end eventually. It's just, you and I were people that don't like that work.
The outcome of that work did give me some joy, right? But the work itself, absolutely not, no.
Right. So, you know, 10, 15, 20, going back even farther, years ago, we had the same story. Oh, automation is we could just automate this stuff. What we're seeing now, and I'm curious what you think about this, because I've seen this talking about, you know, platform development and tool development, is, yeah, we can, it's software, we can write anything. The barrier on that is so much lower now. There's a lot of things we go, well, I could write software to do that, but it would take me, you know, 30 hours to replace a 30-minute job. Just the ROI isn't there. Mm-hmm. But now it is. Now there's something I want to automate, I can automate it quickly. And you're nodding your head. You're seeing the same thing, it sounds like.
Well, that is what I think is an excellent use case for AI. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing as much of that as I would like to see. Or where, you know, so it is quite interesting because, again, people sitting in these kind of camps, right? Mm-hmm. And the people who generally reject the idea of AI being useful for anything, they don't think it's useful for anything. So they don't think about these kind of the opportunity where you can build a small tool that is very specific to your context and your workload, right? And make that easier for yourself. Take some of that friction away somehow. And the other camp, well, they probably do that, to be fair. They maybe push it a little bit too far and maybe don't think enough about the decision-making around that, because that is something that I find is suffering a little bit in both camps, actually, decision making, right? So my old topic, I like to think about making good decisions and how you make good decisions. And I see a lot of kind of knee-jerk reactions right now, or kind of impulsive reactions, and very little of careful evaluation of facts, or doing what testers do, define what a good outcome would look like, and then see if we're actually getting that good outcome. Or are we just getting something that is super impressive, or something that is absolutely not what I was expecting, right?
Yeah, and I want a tangent, because we do that on this podcast, a little bit on decision-making, because one of the things I noticed many, many years ago is, you know, I'm good at pattern matching. I didn't notice that. I've always been good at pattern matching and seeing things. I noticed that the leaders that were very effective and the ones I really liked were all really good at decision-making, regardless of the amount of data they had. They would confidently make a decision and not be afraid to change course if they were wrong. So mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious, and like you talk about it a lot, where does good decision-making, I don't have an answer for this. I'm going to ask you as a hard question. Where does good decision-making come from? How do people get to be good decision-makers or good at making decisions?
So like many things, I think practice helps a lot.
Yes.
Right? So you can practice making good decisions. And I think there are frameworks that you can use if you are struggling, right? I have just actually given a keynote to our friends in Indonesia for their ISQA conference. And I talked a little bit about that. If you look back in history, or even if you, okay, let me reframe that. The book Daniel Kahneman, Thinking mm-hmm. Fast and Slow, yep. was very popular in the testing sphere a few years ago.
It was.
With good reason. I think it's an excellent book. And I think it is a book that I really highly recommend people read. And he talks about the system one and system two, right? Where system one is the fast decision making, where you react before you want to react, really, where you just kind of impulsively respond to things without thinking them through, whereas system two is kind of the deep thinking, collecting facts, sitting with your facts for a little while before you make a decision. So very simplified, but you know, that's kind of the two things. And there are, if you go back in human history and look at philosophy, for example, and through many cultures, there are frameworks that have enabled people to go from system one to system two. Because as humans, we default to system one, and that is what I see a lot around this AI discussion as well.
Yeah, that's a great insight.
So any framework that allows you to move yourself from system one into system two around that is a good framework. And so Aristotelis is a good one, right? So ask, reflect, and respond is that can do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Ask a question, look at the answers without thinking about how you react to them, then play it back to make sure that you have understood your questions, mm-hmm. and then kind of keep probing. This is what testers do naturally. Anyways, we are very good at asking questions. So we can apply what we normally do to this whole AI thing anyways, right? Mm-hmm. Another thing is what we are really good at as testers is define what outcome you're after, like very specifically, right? Don't throw something like, I want the thing to, I don't know, create test cases for me. That's maybe a little bit broad. I'd kind of narrow it down a little bit and define what is okay for you. What amount of hallucinations are you willing to live with? What amount of rework cycles are you happy to live with? How much time are you willing to spend in correcting the output you're getting? Define all those things up front.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking, again, building on what you're saying, I love that answer too, especially starting with just practice making decisions and make some wrong ones too. I think a lot of decision paralysis comes from people afraid to make a wrong decision. I've made a few hundred thousand wrong decisions in my life and probably more on the way, but as long as we learn from them, it's great. No problem.
Yes.
With AI, now I think AI can be a tool to help you move from system one to system two. And both with using AI for coding, using AI for collaborating mm-hmm. on ideas, or using AI to come up with test ideas, there is, and I hate the term prompt engineering. I think it's stupid. But being applying that decision making judgment, applying judgment to the prompts you give AI when using Gen AI can be very powerful. You mentioned about talking about the outcome, and then also asking the Gen AI, and again, it can be wrong, and it's not. And once you understand how they work, you understand why they're wrong, why they can be wrong, and that can help you make better prompts in the first place. But you can ask it, you know, I'd like to understand all the areas that this particular web page could have input issues, and how would you test those? I'm just making up stuff on the fly here. And then it can give you those ideas, and you say, what other types of bugs on this page may I miss because of this approach? And it'll give you some ideas. And what I find is that collaboration, that back and forth, it may not give me the perfect end-all answer, but it gives me an answer that makes me think of more questions. And when we go back to, you know, way back, I think it was Kem Kaner's, maybe it was Box, I don't know, somebody a long time ago talked about definition of exploratory testing, which has probably changed 18 million times since then, but it said simultaneous execution and design of tests or something. And we can do a lot of that with Gen AI a lot faster. And I use it in that way for a lot of different things to help me think through things. Not maybe not even necessarily to generate the output I want, but to help me think more deeply about what I'm trying to get done, because it's you know, the way it pulls information, it can just, it gives me prompts that make me, it almost prompts me back in its answers to think about things in a different way or more deeply.
Yes, exactly. And sorry, I realized I said I was told this. I meant Socrates, of course, right? So I was talking about the Socratic method.
Yeah, the letters are going to come pouring in.
Well, you know, anyways, no, but you're right. And that is what I do. I have actually built a couple of skills. It's a little bit overkill for an agent, but a couple of skills that help me think certain things through just the way you have. So I describe in the skill very clearly how I want the AI to interact with me. And that is because I use it as a discussion partner. Mm-hmm. I want it to ask me questions in a specific way. I want it to recognize when I'm trying to cop out of an answer, for example, and instead then go in and ask me and force me to get a little bit more detailed maybe, or a little bit more precise. So yeah, I'm totally with you. I think it can be an amazing tool for getting into that system tool thinking. But you need to, of course, guide it to be that, which again, I think that is the, so for me, the big promise in AI, in Gen AI really, is that we can all build the tool that we need. We can form it into the thing that we need, right? Provided that we are clear on what we need.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question, because I've been out of the day-to-day testing, even test coaching for many years now. And one thing I noticed on teams when I was doing this more was recognizing when a tool or code would help you be a more effective tester. Before AI, like, oh, I have to do this thing. It just takes me hours, but I got to get it done. I said, and I tell them, well, we can automate this. And say, well, I don't write code. That's okay. Well, let's collaborate. Like, just recognizing that something can be automated, or understanding when the power of code can help you do more effective or efficient testing. That was a problem, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, all the time. How can we take this, I'm not even calling it a mindset, this notion that, I'm calling a notion, the ability to recognize when something can be done more efficiently using the computer to help you was missing from not all, but from a number of testers I worked with, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Today, the ability to recognize when the computer can help you be more efficient, I think, is even more important, because testers are same testers are freaking out because things are moving even faster than they ever have before. So I'm curious, this is a long buildup to a question of, how do you help testers recognize when the power of a computer, whether it's AI or automation, can help them do something more efficiently or effectively? Or are you seeing that problem anymore?
I do see that problem. And I think we are seeing a lot of not super helpful answers around that. Again, right? So again, I think it all comes back to how do you make decisions and how do you observe and how you make decisions in large part depends on how you observe the world around you. And that applies to also to finding opportunities for automation and asking yourself, is this a valuable automation opportunity? Or is this just something that I could automate, but that ultimately gives me no benefit if I automate it, right? And what I try to give people is tools to think through that. Rather than, so another way to phrase it, I don't have a general answer to that. I can give you a process that I think is helpful. And that process generally is, if it involves you making decisions, you probably should not automate it. You should automate everything that helps you make a decision faster, better, with more information, or whatever it is that you need for your decision making, right? But do not outsource the decision making itself.
That's wonderful. That is so concise and so accurate and so helpful. I've been thinking a lot about in some of the previous podcasts we've talked about. AI comes up a lot right now because testers are understanding what to do. I have two questions. I'll ask the first one first because that's usually the way things work better. In a nutshell, like, how do you advise testers, or what do you think testers should be doing now to lean more into AI and use AI to help them versus, we talk about that false dichotomy of it'll solve all my problems versus it'll solve none of my problems. What guidance do you have for testers to find the right way to leverage AI in their current jobs? Like, what should they be doing?
So I think, well, this is probably, I try to be short. I'm not sure that I will be able
We just want the information.
So one of the things is being, for the one camp that I talk about, where people don't want to touch AI, I don't think that is a tenable position right now. I think whether you like it or not, AI, that I don't think that particular genie is going to go back into its bottle.
Nope.
So the first thing I would definitely recommend everybody is try to use it. Try to find a use case for yourself where you can define an outcome that would make your life better and that you think your AI tool or Gen AI or whatever it is. I think most people just get Copilot, Claude, whatever Codex may be.
Sure.
Right? And that gets thrown at them. So try to find a thing that is friction in your workflow where you think this is mechanical. I mean, we are knowledge workers, so we don't really have mechanical tasks, but kind of the equivalent to a mechanical task, right? How can AI take that away from me? Can it do that for me? Can it, I don't know. Maybe part of your day involves sifting through 10,000 logs, right? That is something computers are extremely good at.
Oh, yes. Very, very, very good.
Right? So build yourself a little skill that takes that away and just presents you with a report of things where you actually need to look rather than look at all the things that, you know, we can sort out safely, immediately. That is one thing. The other thing I think is if I was still working as an active tester, I would probably learn about AI evals and how to do those well, including using LLMs as a judge specifically. Because, again, a thing that I hear quite a lot is that, yes, the human in the loop is going to be important, but the human in the loop cannot be the human that reviews all the pull requests, for example. That is not going to work.
No, there's too many coming in.
Right? Because that kind of counteracts the efficiency increase we have. You're just shifting the bottleneck a little bit.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So and the quality of those code reviews, if done by a human, are not going to be great because you have too much of them. You have not been involved in creating the code. It's the quality of those reviews is going to go down. That's just in the nature of it.
Yeah. It's something I talk about a lot. The AI, like, we're generating code so quickly, we can't review it all. They need some AI assistance. We shifted the bottleneck. But I do want to ask you, you may not remember, but a couple of years ago when we talked, and time is weird. It could seem like even longer ago. You talked about the ability for testers to be able to read code. And I had predicted even before then that in the world of AI, the ability to read code was going to become more important than the ability to write code. And that part's, I'm not very often right in my predictions, but that one is becoming more and more true all the time. So I'll pat myself on the back here. At the same time, we can't review all the code. So I'm curious, what's your take on that today? Because, it's kind of a leading answer. I know because we can't read all the code, but what do you, or maybe not, maybe use AI for it. I'll ask a better question. Is that as important, more important, less important than it was 2 years ago, the ability for testers to be able to read code and understand it?
That is a difficult question, actually, I think.
I think it, as I asked it, I realized it wasn't as cut and dry as I thought. It wasn't a softball.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm slightly circumvented direct answer, and what I'm going to say is this: when I recommend people learn to write code, really mainly what I think they need to achieve is to get up close and dirty with the product of their work or the product they work with, and that is not the outcome of the code. That is not the software application, but it is also the thing that drives the software application, and that is the code. And I think I probably said that back then, right? I think testing is one of the very few kind of professions I know where people think they can judge the product without being able to wield the tools, which has always baffled me. But that is a whole different rant. So I think that part is still as true as it always was. And I think it has never been easier to teach yourself to interpret code.
Yeah.
You will not need to write every line of it. You will not need to be able to understand every line of it, but you will need to be able to not have fear going into the code base. And maybe, and again, computers are very good at that, pointing out a bit that you're interested in, and let the AI explain to you what it does.
Yeah, it does a really good job at that. And I was thinking while you were talking, you could, as a tester, if you didn't understand code, to still copy and paste the code change, your testing, or set of code changes you're testing into an AI tool and ask it, you know, as a tester executing manual test cases, what's my best plan of attack here, in some better words. Yes. And it'll probably give you some reasonable ideas. It's not going to be complete. It may be wrong, but it's going to give you some ideas to look at. And from that, again, because I think to me, and you talked about this, also using any one of the Gen AI chatbot tools it's an interactive experience. It's not like, for me, some people use ChatGPT or Claude like a search engine. It's fine, but it's so much more powerful when it's a conversation and use it to collaborate and vet ideas. And I think a lot of folks miss out on that little bit of nuance.
Absolutely agree. And again, so I think it is for it. It has never been easier for people who have not grown up writing code and who have not spent the majority of their time in works writing code. It has never been easier to get close to the code and understand what's happening there. And I think that is really important. I also think maybe I can make a little prediction of my own here. I usually stay away from those. But what I am seeing is that the boundaries between roles are shifting and they're getting fuzzier.
Good. Finally.
Right?
We've been looking for this for decades.
Right? And I think that is just going to continue. And that is not just between developers and testers. That also involves product people, of course, because now every product person can go and whip up a prototype in an afternoon rather than, vying for 2 weeks of development time.
I'm going to go one step farther. I think, and the vibe, I don't know if you saw this Anthropic thing from a month or so ago, but they had a coding contest and a lawyer won. And in fact, a programmer, the highest placing was fourth place. And the reason is, they didn't talk about this. My interpretation is the reason is the domain expert knows so much. And this is why, for at least for the lawyer who won, he knew all the rules around zoning. He's building some zoning, you know, regulation mm-hmm. tool, which was great. It solved a problem for him that took hours and hours of work. He's able to create a program that would do all the work for him. Wonderful. Now, I think something I'm thinking about as I go back to entering the workforce, whether it's consulting or full time, we'll find out, is the whole team. The whole organization can, air quote, once again on the podcast, code, which is a pro and a con. The people in marketing come up with solutions for their stuff, which is great. It's hard enough to teach developers the difference between works and production ready. And that jump from the marketer, hey, it works, can we deploy this to the world? There's the quality challenges and the things that have to be done. You and I understand these because we've been doing it for years and years and years. There's mm-hmm. it's not that we need to test quality into it, but there could be regulatory things. There could be the Gen AI tools often miss security type issues, things like there's all kinds of hardening. We call it yeah. in the biz, that needs to be done even on some of the best non AI written code. So I'm curious on your thoughts on that idea. I'll just say today, the entire organization can create code. What does that mean for testing and quality?
Well, it kind of, like you say, we have been talking about this for years. And I think, this is the part where I don't make predictions, because I think none of us really can predict where this is all going to lead in the end.
Absolutely.
Right? So I think a lot of this is up in the air right now. It feels like it is a meaningful shift in how organizations are structured, or that we will need to see a meaningful shift in how organizations are structured. However, I know that I also thought this about Agile, and that never really
I know.
So we shall see. But I think, and you mentioned domain knowledge, and I think that is exactly the point here. I feel that the team of the future will have to have still some specialization in those domain knowledge, but I think the execution of what a team creates as output will be a more collaborative effort. We also think need to be clear about differentiation between personal tooling, organizational tooling, and product.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it is a difference whether I write a small tool that I use every afternoon for 5 minutes, or whether we write a tool that the organization uses for something, maybe collaborative thinking, right? That would be interesting. I would really like to see some tooling around that evolve mm-hmm. out of the core, the capabilities we now have with AI. Or, like you say, whether we let that loose on a general public that may need protecting in many ways.
Right. And there's even, I like this, and I don't have any answers here. It's just something I've been thinking about. Yeah, the personal tool, have at it. Little automations that save your day, make an invoice easier, yeah. Go at it. Then there's deploying internally at the organization. So it's like another ring of protection. There could be privacy issues. I mean, even in the best well-intentioned companies, there can be bad actors and go, oh, I can leverage this and see all of your email, Kat. So if it's like my email, there's nothing exciting in there. Have at it. But that happened to me at a product at Microsoft once. Someone made a mistake in some token caching, and all of a sudden they saw someone else's email. Internal only, but still a big, big, big deal. So those things need to be covered, handled. And then even if that internal tool is deployed to the cloud in some way, which a lot of them are, they'll be even in a private AWS, there is initial hardening has to happen there. And then if you're going to make this, we want to share this with some customers. Oh, new level of rigor needs to be done here. It's a different kind of education. There's almost, doing training. And I've done training before internally at Microsoft and at Unity. there's a whole set of training around this that goes with, like, you would never teach some of these secure coding practices and ideas, or secure, mm-hmm. I don't even call it coding, secure, just security mindset to the folks in marketing and sales and legal. But we're at a stage now where I think we do.
Yes.
It's an interesting world. So that moves me into another question I want to ask. You've been in quality coaching for quite a few years and been very, as far as I can tell, pretty successful at it. I'm curious on your thoughts on this idea. You've talked a lot about helping teams with AI, and we've talked a lot about teams that can't figure out how the right place in that false dichotomy, that spectrum, I'll call it, of where mm-hmm. to use AI. Do teams need AI coaches? Like, and how much of your job is AI that. Coach now versus test coach? I don't have an answer for this. I'm just thinking, like, I think there's a market there for people to not come in and be an AI expert, but to help people understand the right level of AI for their context and their problem set. But curious on your thoughts.
I have been thinking about that. In fact, I have been offering kind of specific coaching sessions for that, and I'm going to do a test cohort on that. Let's see if people want it, right? So I think yes. And I think those actually sit in a very similar space, the quality coach and the AI coach, right? Again, I think a lot of that has to do with how do we make decisions? How can we help people use those? And maybe that there's even overlap with the deaf role, actually, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Whereas how can we help people make the best use of tools? How can we help them use these tools safely? All of that kind of goes in there. I think it's just another example of, I don't like to say, right, role X is dead or anything like that. No. I do think we will see, like I said before, fuzzier kind of boundaries between roles and overlap that move into different directions. So yes.
Yeah. And yes. And we'll speak the words that have been said for over a decade now. Test is dead, but test isn't dead. It's kind of like the king is dead, long live the king. Test is evolving. It's evolving faster and faster over the past, you know, not just the AI area, since I've been doing it for a very, very long time. And what I see, I'm not going to go deep into this, but just to build on what you said, although it's evolving, some people don't want to change and evolve with it. And what's happening is there's always been a space for those people, but they're getting obsolete faster than they ever have before.
Probably. I mean, yes, we all have a certain amount of inertia, some more than others, right? And I agree, but this kind of throws us back to the what should testers do with AI, right? Again, I think the best way to form an opinion about something is to use the thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
It's hard to form an opinion about a tool if you've never used the tool. If I only ever have a hammer, I don't know if a screwdriver maybe could be super useful for me.
There's a story I've told for a very, very long time. There was a time in my career when I decided I should read a book about testing. So I read a book about testing. I thought, oh, okay, I get it so much better now. And then I read another book. I thought, oh, well, some of these ideas they're conflicting. And then I read a third book. I thought, oh. And it wasn't until after I got that far that I began to form my own opinions. Then I read more and I could critique as I went. If all you have is a hammer, if all your information about how the world works comes from that hammer, the world's going to be a nail for you. I think the ability to form opinions. So we talked about, actually we can go back to another thing we talked about before. We talked about test zombies, the ones who look at the script and follow the script exactly and miss everything going wild over to the sides. I think AI, here's my thought on that. We've seen that happen in the past. I'm just going to blindly and optimistically think that never happens anymore, although I know I'm wrong. Should testers move, or I'm forming a question here. If I was like a good reporter, I have these all written out in advance, but I think as I go, it's exploratory interviewing. Is testing with AI tools, is testing moving to being more of a high level critique versus execution, or are both still equally needed?
I think, again, this kind of brings us back to the testing being the profession that thinks it can critique the thing without understanding the tools, mm-hmm. right? So I think both have always been equally important, and I think both will remain equally important. I think the tooling is shifting, as always, and I think the level of insight we can get from that tooling is maybe changing. Again, so I think it is easier than ever to look under the hood of any application these days for a tester. So for any tester, I think there is no longer any excuse to say, no, the only testing I do is I use the thing as a user.
But you're not the user.
Exactly. I think that was never a good argument.
I hate that one, too.
I know that we agree on this, right? Use those tools. And I think, actually, because Gen AI is so malleable, although those AI tools that we have, they are so malleable, every kind of flavor of tester can use them in a way that plays into their existing skill set. They will have to expand that skill set, of course, right? But if you happen to be somebody who delights in looking at a UI all day long, you can use AI to make that more meaningful. Mm-hmm. If you are somebody who delights in finding tickets in your backlog that don't have great acceptance criteria, you can totally build a little tool that is going to help you do that.
Yeah.
If you want to improve communication in your team, I'm fairly certain you could build a skill that can help do that as well.
Yeah, that's interesting and valuable. And I'm going to build on that with a long intro. A question that's going to be far too long. For context, that we're about 230 episodes into this podcast. Brent and I started this 11 years ago, maybe 12 years ago by now, as a way to, we were seeing testing change as Agile was getting popular. And again, Agile was very popular elsewhere. Microsoft just slow to catch up. And we noticed the role change. We noticed the roles fuzzing and things moving faster. And we started talking about what we talked about on the podcast. We wanted to help testers understand how they could fit in with this new world where quality and delivery were more important than trying to test quality and in doing some of those things. Those things are all exponentially, and I don't use that term lightly, more important because things are moving much, much faster. Testers are much, much more often feel like they're the bottleneck. And they're worried about relevance. There's straw man posts. I don't know how many of them are real, but LinkedIn, as you know, is filled with, a company never named fired all their testers and this quality thing happened. You need to have testers. And yes and no, but like this, how about a well thought out argument with it? And your post is generated by Gen AI. It just drives me crazy. So, and you and I spend enough time with the tools. You and I can spot in a second that post is written by AI. I can tell.
Badly. Right?
So what are, if you're at the risk of stealing some of your consulting ideas, what couple bits of advice, I won't even number them. What's the advice you give a tester trying to stay relevant in this world of fast-moving AI? What are the things they should be learning or doing or thinking about more? Like, how would you, like, if I came to you and said, hey, Kat, I am on a test team. I feel less and less relevant as the team moves faster and faster. I'm worried about my career. What sorts of things should I be doing to stay relevant in this world?
Funny enough, I don't think my advice to all of these changes has really changed all that much over the years. I would still say exactly the same thing. If you want to stay relevant, especially in your... So there are two or three things, right? In your current team, things are moving faster. You feel like you're becoming the bottleneck. Well, figure out one specific thing where you can stop being the bottleneck and remove that friction. And then move on to the next thing and to the next thing. Don't look at it as a systemic issue, which it is, admittedly, right? But no, just solve one problem at a time and you will be extremely relevant. If you are the person who can help the team spend 2 minutes per test run less waiting for those tests to be finished, you have no idea how relevant people will think you are.
Absolutely. That is such a great answer. And it's how I moved from, and I had always been more on the tooling side of testing, but it's how I easily and successfully moved from the testing world into infrastructure and platforms, which is I'm a professional bottleneck identifier and remover. I see patterns and I can use data to find out where the bottlenecks are. And I just one at a time remove them. And in our modern testing principles, we talk about theory of constraints. It makes so much sense. It's all about like what is our biggest pain point or what's blocking us the most. Even knowing that is a huge step forward. And then as a member of the team, regardless of your role, not even solving it yourself, but often just identifying it and then figuring out whether it's by yourself or ideally collaboratively, you use AI to help you reduce or eliminate that bottleneck. And again, it's not eliminating the bottleneck. Mm-hmm. It's reducing it until it's not the biggest bottleneck anymore and then finding the next one.
Yeah. Pure theory of constraints. Find a real problem to solve for your team.
Yeah. Yeah, right? That's it. Find a real problem to solve for your team. Don't just be the information provider, the test executor, the person, the one-dimensional employee. I don't even call it tester.
Exactly. No,
we don't have room for one-dimensional employees in knowledge work.
And I don't think we ever had, to be honest. And that's why my advice really isn't changing all
we
that
much. We tolerated it, though, for a long time.
Exactly. Though there was one other side to that, which I – and again, that also hasn't really changed all that much, which is don't confuse domain knowledge with product knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So testers often pride themselves on their domain knowledge, and I think that is true, but I think often what they mean is product knowledge, which is important to you in your current situation, absolutely. Domain knowledge, however, is a little bit bigger.
Yes.
And use your domain knowledge to build your product knowledge, not your product knowledge to you know, think you have domain knowledge. Yeah, I think that is the other thing that, and again, with the tools we have today, that is easier than ever. To actually build on that and to build yourself a structured way of learning about that.
It is. And it's maybe one final topic before we get into closing. We hinted at this earlier. I thought, oh, I'm not going to go into that soapbox, but I'm going to go into that soapbox. Is we talked about there's a lot of testers that say, I'm the voice of the user. And that's great if you want to tell yourself that. Then I asked these same testers, what do you do to understand the user? And they talk about their product knowledge. And it's like, no, and the way to be the voice of you're not the user. You never are. I don't care if I'm a professional writer and I go to be a tester on a word processing app, I'm still not the user. I'm closer, but I'm not because the user is ideally in a successful product, a collective of a lot of people. And if you want to be the voice of the user, that starts with, data, customer data from telemetry, understanding how they use the product. But in today's world, people talk about the products on Reddit and forums and here and there, and talk about pattern matching. I could point an LLM at a Reddit forum and say, summarize the complaints people have about this product in this forum. And I can get a whole bunch of ideas. Like that is like, you're still not the user, but at least you're making an effort to understand the user. And what drives me wild is the folks who think that I use the product a lot, so I'm the voice of the user, and they're not. And they're just, anyway, curious on your thoughts on that. Like, I think we're of one mind here. There's probably some other ideas you have, but how do you, like, what do you do when you encounter testers that say, I'm the voice of the user?
I don't encounter that many of them. Maybe that is just because I am so publicly outspoken about my opinions that they just avoid you. Contact me, right? And like you say, by the way, so I I actually do have a workflow. If I want to look at something specific like a product, I often will use Perplexity to search for Reddit forums, take the list of that, stick it in a notebook, and then I can, so Notebook LM, Google, right? Great tool, one of my favorites, actually. And then I can interrogate that. Then I have a collection of what people say, and I can ask it questions. And that tool is then going to go and find that. So I don't even have to do anything myself other than find a bunch of links, really. Yes, I have never understood that. So this whole, I'm the voice of the user. I got my first job in testing because I was a heavy user of the product that I then became a tester of. Again, that was product knowledge. That was not domain knowledge because I had zero domain knowledge. I just knew the product very well, and people liked my attitude, and that's how I got into testing, right? The other thing is, you know, often you find that kind of thinking combined with we find the problems that nobody has thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there will always be some problems that you will find that nobody has thought of before. But frankly, most of what these people think of is just bad product discovery. And that should never have made it that far.
Yeah.
So if that is your job, you're really just a cleanup crew. And you should solve a whole different problem.
Another one of my peeves is I don't like when testers think they're the cleanup crew. That's like that's not a very aspirational career.
Right? I mean, important, yes, in many, many ways. I love my career. But you know,
Brent would point out right now that in one of my presentations I really liked, I talked about testers being the champions for the user and having like the superheroes. And I said, but really, you're the cleanup crew. And I show the people shoveling up after horses in a parade. So which one do you want to be? It's actually neither. It's not a dichotomy. Kat, the time has flown by. And
yes,
as I expected, we violently agreed on a lot. But I think I'm super happy that the three listeners will get some great insights. There's some quotable stuff on here, and I'm not sophisticated enough to do cool quotes in my podcast and anything, but it is, man, I really like the way you think. I will post to your LinkedIn and your consulting site. Anything else you want people to know? Anything else you want to say? Anything else, you know, shout outs, credits, other stuff before we close for the day?
Well, no, thank you. Just so pleased to be here. And yes, it was a great conversation. I really enjoyed that. Again. So let's do it again in 3 years. Huh?
We'll make it a yearly thing. I'll send you a meeting. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I would like that. Yearly tradition.
Anyway, love talking with you. And the thing is, if we talk again in a year, the world will have changed that much, hugely more. It'll be a whole new conversation. It's interesting. It's a new conversation with the same roots. We just talk about different things. That's the funny part.
Yes, I totally agree. So in a year from now, we will probably be talking about which AI models are still alive and what token costs had to do with that.
Okay, I'm going to save that. And actually, I can save that because the last little bit is, you talked about Notebook LLM a little bit ago. I have, again, with the help of AI, I use Whisper AI and some Python to create transcripts of every podcast episode that are uploaded to a GitHub repo where we have access to. And then Notebook LLM is connected to those. So I can go query any question I have about anything ever been on 230 plus some other side things. It's like 250 episodes of A/B testing and find out anything I want. I can ask like, what episode was Brent eating while recording? And it'll tell me one of the times I made fun of him. So it's great.
Right. I say Notebook LLM, you potentially can even just stick a link to the podcast in there. To be fair.
Oh, that's new maybe since I've been playing with
it. Oh, is it not? Well, I don't know.
Or I didn't know it was there. You never know.
I know it works with YouTube videos, but I don't know if
very other cool. media works. Very cool. We'll find out. Maybe I'll try that sometime. All right. Again, Kat, it has been amazing. No, thank you so much. This has been A/B testing.
Thank you.